This podcast is being recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay respects to elders past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge their ongoing connection to land, waters, and culture. Colonization and genocide are ongoing processes that continue to this day. Sovereignty was never ceded. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Auspol Snack Pod, the weekly podcast where we bring you bite-sized chunks of Australian news and politics with a healthy serving of crispy, crunchy memes. And we're also the official podcast of the Auspol Shitposting Facebook group. My name's Noon. On Facebook, I'm Ino Funkenstein, and I'm the admin and creator of Auspol Shitposting. And with me, as always, is my colleague, co-host, and collaborator,
Zach LeSnack. Hey, everybody. How you going? It's a special day, as we all know, the first Sunday of May, which means that, of course, it is the 45th anniversary of Sony introducing the Betamax video cassette recorder in Japan,
which is
back
just
in 1975.
You know, a seminal moment in the history of the world, really, as well as Australian politics. You know,
I still have an enormous Betamax collection that I watch regularly.
It's the ideal way to intake media.
Yeah, I think so. Beyond that, the higher quality started to really detract from the feel and atmosphere of the recordings. Mm. So that's where I stopped going next gen after that. That was the last gen for me.
This is also a nice day because we have a new patron, which is our friend who we've mentioned many times on the show, Tom Rowie, who is, I'm going to go ahead and say, my favorite greens hack, my favorite watermelon, my favorite reformist socialist. Tom, thank you very much for supporting the show and for donating on Patreon. And we're probably
and
also
for taking one for the team and going on Sky News from time to time.
Yes, yeah, it is really taking one for the team.
Somebody's got to do it.
And also welcome to any new listeners that we have this week who might have tuned in from our mini Marxist meme theory episode. The first episode came out this week and we got quite a few listens, including a bunch from the US and Japan. So any United Statesian or Japanese listeners, thank you for tuning in.
All right, Noon, do you want to take us through our intro? Our entree?
Our entree.
Far out. Entree.
For those who are new listeners, we're called Snack Pod because we make really weak indirect food puns. And here's our first one is our entree.
We baked it into the entire podcast and now we can't escape it.
Baked it in, yeah. Okay, well, this first story is pretty heavy. It's about George Pell. So if you don't want to hear about that, you might want to skip ahead a couple of minutes. We'll put in a timestamp in the notes. But as we discussed a few episodes ago, George Pell's actual criminal conviction was rejected on appeal, so he's now out of jail. But the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sexual Abuse have released a interim report, I'm fairly sure it is, that has said that basically Pell repeatedly lied to them when he was giving evidence. And he said that he didn't know he was helping pedophile priests avoid scrutiny. When he moved them from parish to parish, he didn't know that they were pedophiles. He was just sort of doing normal church shit, as far as he claimed. Specifically, a lot of this is about Father Gerald Ridsdale, who we know was a good friend of Pell's and who Pell moved out of certain parishes into other ones to avoid scrutiny and punishment. And so here's a quote from the commission findings. While in some cases his evidence about notorious allegations was accepted by the commission, many of his submissions in relation to what he knew about offending in Ballarat and Melbourne were described as implausible, inconceivable, or not tenable, which is pretty fucking damning. The Catholic Church is now facing at least 500 civil cases, so not criminal cases, which would result in jail time or whatever. These are civil cases where the outcome, basically, if they're upheld, will be damages, you know, $1 million of psychological damage or whatever it is. And this report is going to make it much, much easier for the prosecutors who have to show things like a neglect of duty of care on behalf of the Catholic Church. And there were two lawyers who were interviewed in this ABC article who, yeah, each of them is dealing with like 200 to 300 cases of people who are trying to sue the Catholic Church. So that looks like that's going to really kind of ramp up in the next little while. And this some good news about this finding is that it's going to make it much easier for those people to make those cases.
And the reason this is coming out now is because It was redacted earlier when this report was released, while Pell's court case was still making its way through the courts, because it was felt that the findings might prejudice a jury. And yeah, they probably fucking would have, because
in
they
that
said
they
that
provide evidence in support of the case. Yeah. It's
so another great example of our legal system working great to
just
defend
perfectly.
The rights of people who have been the victims of abuse. Yeah, fucking awesome.
Yeah, that's about all for this. Just as the ABC article says, history will not judge Pell kindly. And I think that's true. And this report is really sealing the deal there. By the way, listeners, this is not news related, but if there's some strange scratchings and thumpings in the background, that's just my dog, who normally isn't present when I record the podcast. So my apologies.
All right, moving on. Play that little sting. Hey, man, I got some more beers.
Oh, I don't know if I can drink anymore. I'm feeling kind of sick.
No, come on, we're having another round of Coronas. Yes, more Corona news.
Oh, just what I wanted.
Because there's always more. Who doesn't want to hear about Corona? I don't think anybody is sick of hearing about it.
No.
Especially not from Scott fucking Morrison. But there was, I guess, you know, some actually relatively major news this week. Which is that the government has introduced a three-step plan for easing the lockdown restrictions. So Morrison says that he hopes that the step three will be achieved by July, and that means, you know, basically life returning pretty much to normal. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to give shitpost of the week to this, but I did want to shout out a runner-up for shitpost of the week, Bren Kare Riddick, who posted the photo of Morrison holding up
a piece of paper, like a sign, a diagram,
has the like the diagram of the three steps on it, and Bren Kare Riddick has very helpfully painted out and created a blank template of Scott Morrison holding up a blank piece of paper, which Bren Kare Riddick promptly drew dick butt on. Mm-hmm. So thank you very much for that post.
And just another reminder to
Kurt Van Houten's dignity.
That's a,
which
a classic.
Pretty funny, and like a number of people jumped in the comments with their own variations. So always fun to see people.
If there are any government ministers listening,
coming together.
I just want to remind you to never, ever, ever, under any circumstances, hold up a piece of paper on camera. It'll just say, I'm a big, ugly moron with a stinky butt, and I like to kiss my own butt, and my butt stinks. Yeah.
It's just it's like not that helpful when because you can't fucking see anything that's written on it, like in the photo itself. And also, Scott Morrison's like, yeah, it's a three-step plan, and he pulls out this thing that clearly has, like, 15 to 20 little discrete boxes on it, and you're like, wait, where are the three? But anyway, here are what the three steps are. Step one is you can have 5 people in your home and public gatherings of up to 10 people, so you're going to have some shops reopening, traveling within states themselves for, like, recreation be allowed again. Students are going to be back in classrooms. And importantly, apparently, golf and boot camps are going to be back on.
Essential. And
I don't know what boot
saunas.
Camps are, and I could have easily... No, not yet.
Not
That's
yet. Oh, sorry.
Later
sorry.
Step. I don't know what the fuck boot camps are, and obviously I could have looked it up, but I deliberately didn't because I wanted to do this bit about not knowing what the fuck they are and why they're so important that they need to get continually mentioned in government announcements about what's allowed.
Yeah, I mean, like,
are
default,
they just going to
I would
a park and
a...
doing push-ups with a... With 10 other people?
Yeah, I mean, like, maybe it's like a intense workout thing. It could, I mean, you also have, like, coding boot camps, which are the same thing, but not for physical exercise. You'd learn to code real quick instead. But, I mean, I guess that's technically also a contagion hotspot,
yeah.
But who knows? Anyway,
workout for your brain. Yeah, so that's step one. Step two is going to be basically the same as that, but with double the amount of people, so public gatherings of up to 20. And Scott Morrison made a hilarious joke about bar classes being back open. Another thing that I didn't know what they were.
Yeah.
Which neither did Scott Morrison. Yeah. Which, you know, just begs the question, like, who put it in there in order for him to, like... Because, you know, he announced it a couple of weeks ago. He said something about bar classes, but he mispronounced it and was like, I don't know what this is. And now he's like, haha, I mispronounced that word one time. Aren't I relatable? The answer is yes. We all love you very much, Scott. Step three, gatherings of up to 100 people, including at restaurants and cinemas and stuff. But restaurants and cafes are still going to have to do the 4 square meters per person thing.
Weird.
Inside. And,
it's weird to have both of those at the same time. Like, are there any 400 square meter restaurants in
Melbourne?
And
the other funny thing, like, about step two is they say you can have gatherings of 20 people and they specify that cinemas, galleries, and stadiums can have 20 people. Like, who's going to open a stadium to put 20 people
yeah.
in? Whatever. And step three is going to be most people going back to work in the workplace, supposedly, which sounds garbage to me, but whatever.
Yep.
And interstate travel is going to resume. So one thing that was pointed out on the Osball Shitposting Facebook group, I think by Cassandra, was that strip clubs and brothels are staying closed at all stages of restriction. So there's nothing about reopening them.
Mm.
Even though they did specifically mention, as you said, Noon, that in step three, saunas are going to be back open, like bathhouses and saunas, which, you know, it's just for like recreational sex stuff as opposed to sex work, which, I don't know, nice to see the government taking any opportunity to put the boot into sex workers, I
yeah.
guess.
There's been all of those, you know, photos of, like, drive-through strip clubs in the US. Yeah, anyway. Don't have to go into that whole lot of detail, but yeah, it's people are finding ways around.
Know, yeah, nice to see a little bit of ingenuity, I guess. Yeah, so, I mean, that's really unfortunate. Obviously, like, a lot of sex workers have a very precarious employment.
Yeah.
To begin with, because they, you know, they're not going to get sick leave at a time like this. So, you know, that was a real shame to see. But so the timing of all this is going to be up to the states. It's not it's like a federally developed plan, but basically it's up to the states to decide when these steps come into effect. The Northern Territory and South Australia are going to be relaxing those restrictions the quickest as of next week, if you're hearing this, or this week, I guess. Western Australia still is going to have its border restrictions in place, so they're staying pretty locked down for the time being. And New South Wales and Victoria are moving at the slowest pace because they obviously have the biggest continuing outbreaks, which is something that is making conservative politicians really angry, like, especially in Victoria.
It's just amazing. Like, I have so little faith in the politicians of our country, but they just managed to disappoint me so consistently.
The Michael Jordan of being terrible politician.
Yeah.
Just when you think they couldn't be any more of an asshole. So I think probably this is a good point to transition into
Shitpost of the Week.
So, as we always say on the show, there are shitposts and shitposts. And, this week, we've got one of each. First off is the shitpost. And this goes to someone who, according to their entire Facebook name, is Victorian Liberal leader Michael O'Brien MP.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like if he was the Victorian Liberal leader, we might know his name. So that seems like it must be a fake page.
Yeah, or what he looked like.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a bit of a strange one. He's got a great cover image on his Facebook page, by the way, which is just him smiling at two cops. we've got a post from Victorian Liberal leader Michael Bryan MP's Facebook page, which was posted into the Auspol Shitposting Facebook group to Trichotrea papiata. So that's the layup assist to Trichotrea.
Said that. That was amazing. I've been looking at those words on our like notes document for like 5 minutes, being like, oh, I hope Zach is saying those words. And you did. You just pumped him out. That's great.
It's a must, as we all know.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah. Let it never be said that I don't do my fucking research. Okay. So Trichotrea posted into the group this post from Michael O'Brien MP, which is this amazing meme of a pretty severe looking like old white woman looking wistfully out a window, and the text on the image says, "Across Australia, states have been easing restrictions to allow families to meet and support each other,
but not Victoria.
Why can't Victorians visit their mums on Mother's Day, Mr. Andrews?" So firstly, obviously overlooking that it's much more important that it's the anniversary of the release of Betamax today, but whatever.
Some people don't know how to prioritize events, but...
You know who you can't visit on Mother's Day, Mum? Mother's Day? Noon?
Nope. I'll just let you keep going with that one.
A dead Mum. maybe we shouldn't be going and infecting our mums even on Mother's Day. But, you know, you got to think of all the florists and chocolatiers who are going to be suffering a massive loss of income. It's all about the economy when you think about it.
It's also
a truly
just like
shit post.
Watching in the US as armed militia groups like storm the state capitol buildings to ask for their or demand their right to die from this horrible virus and lose many family members. It's just horrifying to see Australian conservatives continue their tradition of like unquestioningly copying American conservatives, despite it being just completely idiotic. Just terrible. Just
like,
disgusting.
Obviously a very different situation. We are doing way better because
yes.
we've been way stricter about this.
Yes.
It's, you know, also this like totally galaxy brain logic of, see, it's not even that bad. Not that many people have died. And those that have, people I didn't care about anyway.
Yeah.
We should lift these restrictions. Like, no, having the restrictions in place is what means it hasn't been that bad. It, look, whatever. It's very silly stuff. Terrible post from Michael Bryan MP, who I'm sure was trying to make a name for himself with this post and, you know, continues to wow and dazzle the Victorian public with his political noo. So the actual shitpost of the week this week is going to Spoon Sue Speechley. Congratulations, first time winner.
Many long term contributor to the group and a valued member of our community. But yes, first time shitpost of the week winner.
Yeah. Thank you, Spoon Sue. So I didn't mention earlier on, but Morrison kind of said a bunch of weird shit in that like press conference
yeah.
where he announced the three-step plan. And I mean, there's been a lot of discussion about like his tone when he talks publicly and how he just kind of always seems like he's chastising and being really negative. And that's true. I don't really care about it because it's ultimately relatively inconsequential. But watching the whole press conference, it is weird. You're like, why are you talking like this? So there are a couple of like interesting quotes. One was, you know, you can stay under the doona forever and you'll never face any danger, but we've got to get out from under the doona at some time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, I mean, in this analogy, hiding under the doona is stopping people from dying from a pandemic. So like,
I mean,
it's kind of a strange, like comparing people who don't want others to die from a disease to kids, like
being afraid of an imaginary
thing.
Because
they think there's a boogeyman. Yeah.
Also, you made us go under the doona, Scott. You know, like, I mean,
idea.
I'm not saying you shouldn't have. I reluctantly acknowledge you've done a reasonable job with putting doonas on
We're
everyone.
Under the doona with you,
but
huffing your farts, bro.
Yeah, we do. We want to get out from under the doona. Believe us. But
yeah.
Go on, Zach. There's an even...
We don't like it under the doona. Yeah. But then there was this perler where he said, I mean, as I said the other day, it's like the emu and the kangaroo.
Huh.
They go forwards, not backwards. And that's how this has to work.
Okay.
And so Spoon Sue Speechley has screen capped that bit of the quote and put it next to the image of Bill. Well, it's not Bill Clinton. It's one of the aliens from The Simpsons pretending to be Bill Clinton in a presidential debate saying, we must move forward, not backwards, upward, not forwards, and always twirling towards freedom.
When I was a young boy, I dreamed of being a baseball.
Baseball?
Yeah.
It's really a great scene.
It is. And is pretty much what's going on, you know? It's,
it's reasonably
accurate.
Like, The Simpsons just, they hit the nail on the head, and so did Spoon Sue. So thank you for your contribution, and congrats on your shitpost of the week win.
I would like to tell a small story that we may have to cut for time later, but when I was in Israel, we did Zionist propaganda classes that were literally, it was called Hasbara, which is a Hebrew word that is translated by Zionists as Israel advocacy and by people who aren't Zionists as Israel propaganda class. One of the things that we were taught by this journalist who was like for the Jerusalem Post or something, and he was like, whenever anyone says anything critical of Israel, just when you reply, use the words children, future, hope, and peace as quickly as possible. And we would practice doing this. So it'd be like, so why has Israel continued their aggressive genocide of the Palestinians? And we would say back, look, Israelis are just hoping for a peaceful future for our children. The children of Israel just want to have peace in a future that they can hope for, or that sort of thing. And I feel like,
I'm convinced.
This Simpsons scene is remarkably similar. We're moving forward, not backwards. We're hoping for a future, not of peace. a bud of hope.
Oh, and say something patriotic about Australia, like, I don't know, shout out two native animals.
Yeah.
Even if it doesn't make any sense. Yeah. No, I mean, he is a top-tier, first-class orator. I don't think anybody would argue with that. I personally enjoy getting all my government information from somebody who feels like they're telling me off for pinching $10 from his wallet. Moving on.
All right, now we have...
It was the best of
takes.
It was the blurst of
takes.
You stupid monkey.
And this time it was a blurst take, unfortunately. I feel like it often is. But this is a blurst take by everyone's favorite American, Australian politician, Christina Keneally. Definitely not a beneficiary of the corrupt New South Wales Labor Party. And she wrote an opinion piece in the Sunday Age and the Sun Herald where she called for a cut to temporary migration after the COVID-19 lockdown ends in order to, and I quote, put Australian workers first. And she said that Australian workers must get a fair go and a first go at jobs.
Jesus Christ.
And that the country...
You just literally wouldn't know that she's not
the,
a liberal.
Quote, left party, yeah. She said the country has an unprecedented chance to overhaul the immigration system, particularly the temporary work intake, which is currently not capped. And she said that the approach used by successive governments of using immigration to boost economic growth is, quote, lazy, and suggested the overall migrant intake would be lower under Labor.
Well, that's some nice plausible deniability there.
Yeah.
No. I didn't call migrants lazy. I called government policy lazy.
Involving migrants. Yeah, yeah. Just by the way, the piece was called, Do We Want Migrants to Return in the Same Numbers? The answer is no. And here's just a small quote from it. It's not just the number of temporary migrants that affects wages. Maybe I'll try and do an American accent. It's not very good, but the coalition's migration policies actually encourage employers in certain geographic areas and some industries to pay temporary migrants a much lower wage than what Australians would earn doing the same job. Who we bring in matters too. The shift to temporary migration means that our migrant intake is younger and lower skilled than it used to be, and this does not help our kids as they join a labor market with 11% youth unemployment. But that's just...
You know, that really actually helps the convey the tone of what she's talking about.
Yeah.
It's extremely American rhetoric that she's using.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's also not true, as with most American rhetoric, because as anyone with even a faint semblance of an understanding of economics will tell you, migrants increase demand. They also tend to be on welfare less and for shorter periods than people born in Australia, and they create more businesses than people born in Australia. Just masses more, 10% more.
Noon, but I'm not in the business of telling the truth. I'm in the business of winning elections. You know what the people want? Racism by the fucking barrel full, and that's what they're gonna get.
It turns out she's not in the business of winning elections either, but, you know.
So I've just done all this racism for no fucking reason?
Well, it's not for no reason. It has made the world a much worse place, so, you know.
True. Which obviously is the overarching goal here.
I just want to really hone down on the fact that this is complete bullshit and makes no sense. Jobs are not a limited resource. The more people in a country, the more jobs that are created. And... just for example, we never talk about how people having babies might steal jobs from people who are already alive, because that doesn't make any fucking sense. And exactly the same logic applies to migrants. The more people who come...
Even when it was migrants, I knew it was babies.
Yeah, that's right. And the coalition implementing... I agree with Christina Keneally that the coalition's immigration policy, and especially their migrant worker policy, is fucked. But it's because the laws allow people to underpay those people and abuse their labor and exploit them. And the solution
is the fault of migrants.
Worse labor laws, right?
Didn't come here, then they wouldn't get exploited, Noon. Think about it. Come on, be logical about this.
And I just
I know. It's just from literally someone in a party called the Labor Party, being all these exploited workers. People are exploiting them, not paying them enough. I wonder if the problem is the workers existing. Maybe if we get rid of the workers, there won't be any more exploitation.
It's also literally exactly the same rhetoric that was used when the Labor Party was supporting the White Australia policy, which, to be clear, was a Liberal policy, but the Labor government supported it. And I'm not saying they're literally enforcing a White Australia policy, but exactly the same rhetoric is used to support this policy as that, which is the Australian jobs or whatever. And
it's pretty White Australia. They're not talking about immigration from the
Britain.
Fucking UK.
Yeah. And it's just another example of the ALP trying to outflank the Libs from the right and just losing support as a result. And I'm always, you know, sad but pleased when Labour hacks criticise their party for horrible policy. And I just wanted to shout out to Labour hacks. So I'm not sure either of them actually listen to the show, but Connor and David Pink have both been, putting the Labour Party on blast. So good on you guys. It's nice when Labour supporters have, like, the willingness to criticise when their party is being awful.
Yeah. Fuck them.
All right, and now it's time for...
You fucked up.
This is just a real quick one. Anastasia Palaszczuk, Premier of Queensland, got a vaccination on camera on, I think it was like a morning news show. She's like sitting there and the nurse comes up and like injects her and she's like, oh, didn't even feel it. That was easy. And, you know, just continues going with the interview. But... she didn't get it. She didn't, like, the injection was fake. The cap was still on the needle. And you can see in the video, the nurse is, like, pretends to take it off and then pretends to press the plunger, but doesn't, and then, like, puts it down very hurriedly. But you can see that the cap's still on the whole time. So, anyway. this is a funny one.
Just,
because,
like, if you can't do... don't do the photo op. If there's a risk that it's just going to make you look much sillier than you already did, just don't do it. What's the benefit?
Well, the other thing is, I wonder if she was like, oh no, I really don't want an injection, don't do it, I'll scream and cry, just do it with the cap. Or if the producers were like, oh, we don't want this to go badly, just do a fake one, whatever. It doesn't really matter if she gets it or not. It's the visual that's the thing. But either way.
I guess I assumed that she'd like already gotten her shot and was like, oh, well, you can't have another one. But the idea of her actually being really afraid of the injection is much funnier.
All right, that's all for the fuck up.
You fucked up. You know who didn't fuck up?
Who's that?
This person who submitted a potluck, which is when listeners record a little bit of audio of themselves talking about an issue that they are interested in, thinking about, want to tell us about, and now it's time for that segment.
Beautifully introduced sec. Let's play
Thank
that.
Thank you. Yeah, okay.
Potluck, where you bring the snacks.
Hi Noon, hi Zach, long-time listener, first-time potlucker. I wanted to talk about the state of the arts in Australia and how things are obviously becoming worse during our time in the Rhone Zone and what we can do about that. So consecutive Conservative governments have been slowly working to defund the arts for, you know, the better part of a decade now. And what we keep seeing is a lot of toothlessness when these arts organisations engage in political discussion and fear, I believe, of biting the hand that feeds. But as we are continuing to see, especially in the last week with the closure of Carriage Works and the continued defunding of major arts organisations, either directly or the suffocation of them through a lack of access to things like JobKeeper, is that Conservatives don't particularly like the arts because the arts challenges a lot of what conservative politics holds dear. And what I'd love to see is more artists and more arts institutions being quite upfront about what it not only what it costs to make their art, but also how people's voting and political habits have an impact on the artistic landscape that they either very consciously or not that consciously partake in. I mean, one extreme version of this would be to have ticketing restricted based on people's voting habits. And I understand there's a lot of problems with doing that, perhaps. But there's a part of me that likes the idea of making it very explicit to coalition voters that if you do want to come to this show, you are going to have to pay significantly more because you're voting for an arts landscape where artists have to survive solely on the goodwill of their audiences as opposed to larger government funding, which allows them to explore things, especially when the Australia Council for the Arts, which is the federal funding body, demonstrates how an artist-led funding platform will over and over again support really creative and experimental work that has a much greater impact on our culture, both domestically and internationally, rather than something that's at the beck and call of some large philanthropic donor who may just want to listen to the classics over and over again, which is really fucking boring. But then again, a lot of the people who would do this are independent artists who already have an audience that is not conservative voting. So maybe this message doesn't really lead anywhere. Perhaps the best we can hope for is that we see some sort of trickle-up effect where independents influence the decisions made by smaller arts companies, which in turn influence the decisions made by mediums, which will, in time, lead to the Sydney Theatre Company ritualistically executing the Prime Minister live on stage. I'm going to buy my subscription now.
Yeah, thanks, Morgan. That's great. It's about three times longer than we normally ask our potlucks to be, but it's a very good one, and I appreciate it. I realize you were making a serious point about the like politicization of different industries and so on, but I took away from it that we should all try to low-key bully any conservative voters in our lives by making them pay extra for things. I think that is a very good takeaway that not only arts organizations, but just everyone can do, you know? If you're at a cafe, instead of the cops giving them a free coffee, which I used to have to do at many cafes I worked at, just charge them like $8. It'll be fine. Very unlikely to be persecuted as a result.
Yeah. Some of the other big news that came out this week was that Carriage Works closed down.
Yeah.
For those who don't know, that's like a big cultural and arts like precinct in Sydney, which hosted a lot of like really, really diverse performance organizations and arts groups, and was really a great little cultural hub for, I think it's been around for coming up to 15 years.
Yeah.
And yeah, they've gone into administration. KPMG was called in, so it's pretty vicious. The other thing that Morgan mentioned when he sent this in was, and thank you for the potluck, Morgan. He mentioned that he was inspired partially by this piece by Alison Croggan, called Arts Funding, A Survey of Destruction. I'll link to this. I'm not sure that I 100% agree with the approach that she takes to discussing the issue. There's a lot of kind of like financial discussion about, you know, how much funding the arts gets. But ultimately, it is fucked, and it's a sign of what the government thinks of the arts.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to read this quote from it, which I thought was very nice. She says, "The federal funding systems for our culture have been systemically undermined over the past decade because the federal government has an ideological agenda to destroy anything in Australian culture that is worth a hill of beans. In its place, the government is busy erecting a monument that it calls Western civilization, even though what it's proposing, a huge war museum that no one wants or a stunt on circumnavigating Australia to commemorate a voyage that literally never happened, has nothing to do with either of these terms. Instead of culture, we'll have an endless parade of vacuous nationalistic propaganda," which is definitely where we're headed if we don't support our arts organizations and demand that they are treated with the same respect as, e.g., the mining industry.
Yeah.
By the government. So, yeah, I think it's an important thing. There's a lot to unpack there, and, you know, a lot about the arts industry that is problematic in and of itself as well. But it's, you know, we need to preserve and improve those parts of our culture, burn them and in their wake erect what Alison Croggan describes as vacuous nationalistic propaganda. Because that's what we'll get. Cool.
All right. Now, we're just going to do our First Nations story. This is quite a brief one, and it's a really nice little story about a young Nawatakan woman named Natasha Yibabuk, who lives in West Arnhem Land. That's where the Nawatakan people are. And she's 14 years old, and she's been making like educational apps to record and teach cultural knowledge of her people and her community. She's made three so
very
far,
cool.
And she's working on a fourth one. So she's done one about calendars, like a sort of a traditional calendar, which is one that I'm particularly interested in. Obviously, like, I'm in Melbourne, and like as far away on this continent as you can get from Arnhem Land, so the calendar that she has isn't relevant here. But I always think it's like ridiculous that we use a calendar developed by druids in France in a completely different land. So anyway, I always find First Nations calendars particularly engaging and thrilling to learn about. Anyway, she's done one about
it. I'm sick of druids telling me how to live, honestly.
Fuck those guys. Sickles. She's also done one about animals and one specifically about kangaroos, and now she's working on a fourth one about kinship relationships, which, again, is really fascinating, and Moiti, fascinating part of First Nations like culture and society that a lot of white people don't know anything about. I only know the tiniest little bit. I have been trying to find if we can download these apps. I've gotten in touch with the school that she studies at to see if I can get them, but no news on that so far. But that's the other cool thing about the story, is that she is a student at this sick institution called the Noadican Academy, which her parents helped found. It's about 5 years old. It's a bicultural school, so like both Noadican and white Australian, or not white Australian, but like, you know, the mainstream.
Yeah, like state education.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah, yeah. But it also really specifically focuses on the Noadican people, traditional knowledge and practices and stuff. So it's only been around 5 years and it's more than doubled in size. It's still pretty small. There's only like 15 to 20 students at any one time, but it's like, yeah, gone up. I think there were like five in the first term or something. And so she learned to code at that school through a program run by a company called In Your Pocket Software, IYP Software, which is run out of Melbourne. I don't think they're specifically Indigenous, but they do a lot of work with Indigenous communities. And one of them is, yeah, going to different communities and teaching people how to code. So yeah, that's just super sick. She's like taking on leadership roles. She's only 14, obviously, but her parents are like really important people in the community and helped found the academy. So it's this really nice story of, yeah, First Nations people and communities creating institutions for themselves and then benefiting enormously from it. And then those benefits immediately going back into the community.
Rippling out.
Yeah, yeah. And just like goes to show how our like paternalistic approach to education is absolutely the wrong way to do it, and empowering the communities themselves to educate themselves is obviously the right solution, but just there's one more little piece of evidence that says that's how we should be doing it.
Absolutely. Thanks, Noon. That was a really lovely story.
All good.
All right, it's probably time for our mains. Noon, you want to hear what strained, vaguely food-related pun I've come up with this
week? I absolutely do, and so do all of our listeners, Zach. So please.
Great. Well, you're in for a treat. This week we are eating Monero bite selections. Because there's a by-election in Eden Monero, which I think last week when we mentioned it, we may have pronounced Monaro, and I don't know what's right, but I'm going to go with Monero because it's fancy. Just like
Can Queen I just Bay. Say, I am particularly impressed with this strained food pun that you've come up with, Zach, because unlike most of our food puns, which tend to be about dishes or whatever, you know, quashed quiche or whatever, this is just a pure, like, straight-up pun about eating. And I don't know. It's elegant.
Yeah, well, I've gone straight to the source. I'll cut out the middleman. So we did mention that last week briefly that this was going to happen because the sitting Labour MP stepped down and, you know, the by-election was coming up. But we wanted to talk a bit about it this week because there have been shenanigans.
Yeah.
And when we talked about it last week, I made the extremely prescient prediction that there would be shenanigans because it's a by-election. And,
shenanigans ahoy.
I just wanted to, shenanigans ahoy. I just want to read this message that I was sent by friend of the show, Lewis, who said, "Once again, Australia's foremost political nobodies were right on the money." So,
hey, that's very kind. Thank you. We are Australia's foremost political nobodies.
Yeah. And boy, have there been shenanigans this week. Most of it concerns people who ultimately have nothing to do with the story anymore. but it's funny to talk about. We're going to talk about it. So, start from the top. The sitting MP, Labour's Mike Kelly, is leaving politics due to poor health, and his partner is also having severe health issues. He was holding the seat on a margin of 1%. So, this is a seat that's usually
like
held
less
by
than
either of major parties.
Wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I've got the exact number in here somewhere.
Sure.
The Nats don't particularly perform well here. It's usually a major party seat. And in fact, the Nats came in behind the Greens last year.
Which is weird because it's like a semi-rural seat. It's
so it's coastal New South Wales. It contains Bega, which is, yeah. And so it's, you know, a seat that was hit really hard by the bushfires is really the major thing that's happened there over the last little while. But so, yeah, it's a rural New South Wales seat. And as far as the by-election goes, history is on Labor's side, as has been said over and over again in the media and also on this podcast. A government has not won a seat from an opposition at a by-election in 100 years.
I love when, these, like, very carefully qualified statistics. like, it reminds me of a boring cricket day. Not that I've watched much cricket, but, like, you know, when there's not a whole lot going on, and the commentators are like, now that's the most birds that we've seen on a third innings before 10 o'clock since July 1916.
True. I mean, this was something that was said by, God, what's the German guy's name?
Matthias Gormann?
Yes, thank you. Fucking hell. Can't even know if he's German, but whatever. This is something that he said because obviously there's political advantage for the coalition trotting out this line because it makes them look like the underdogs here, which, you know, in a certain respect, I guess they are, as much as you can be when you're the incumbent government. I just have this note here, which the last time that a government won a seat from an opposition in a by-election over 100 years ago was in 1920 when pro-Irish MP Hugh Mann was thrown out of Parliament for disloyalty to the British Empire.
Yeah, good on him.
I don't know why that... Yeah, good on him. I
pro-Irish, anti-British Empire. Sounds like a bang-up dude.
Big ups, Hugh Mann. Hugh Mann. Am I being played here?
No. But that is very funny.
Yeah. Okay. So, coalition rules state that both Liberal and Nationals can contest an open seat. So, there's, you know, they were setting themselves up for a little bit of conflict there.
So, when you say in an open seat, that means if there's not a Lib or National MP already in that seat, then both of them are allowed to contest. And this, every election, there's mild pushing back and forward between the Nets and the Libs in seats where sitting members have resigned and that sort of thing. And they're always trying to get each other not to run.
Yes, constantly. So the Liberal candidate who was looking most likely was a guy called Andrew Constance. So he's currently the New South Wales Minister for Transport, and he's the local member for Bega. So that's like sits within the federal seat of Eden Monaro. So his area was hit really badly by the bushfires, as I mentioned, and he was one of the politicians who was really on the front lines, like helping out in any way that he could. And he seems to have been quite deeply emotionally and psychologically affected by the bushfires, you know, as you would expect. Basically most of the houses on his street burned down. His house survived, but some people close to him say that they reckon he's suffering from like survivor's guilt that. So it's been a rough year for him. And he said that he was going to quit politics once the bushfire recovery was over. But here's the thing. The seat of Eden Monaro contains the town of Cobargo, and you might remember that is where the handshake thing happened with Scott Morrison when he was doing his bushfire response tour, and he went to shake this woman's hand. She wouldn't shake his hand, and he like grabbed it and forced her to shake his hand. That was in the seat of Eden Monaro, so he doesn't have a good reputation in this seat, Morrison.
Yeah.
So they thought, why don't we take this guy who was there on the front lines, who suffered personally and is known by the local community, drop him in here in order to counterbalance Morrison's bad
unpopularity
rep from, yeah, his unpopularity for his handling of the bushfire crisis.
I think Nellingen is also in Eden Monaro, as in tell the PM get fucked from Nellingen. I'm not 100% about that, but yeah.
A lot of people within Eden Monaro are pretty happy for the PM to go get fucked.
Mm-hmm.
Andrew Constance had the Morrison's official backing to be a Liberal candidate. So he announced his candidacy this week on a time of recording on Tuesday. Then on Wednesday, he withdrew his candidacy. So
it's the kind of astute political foresight and planning that I've come to expect from the Liberal National Party.
Look, there's probably a bunch of reasons for this.
Sure.
For one, the Liberal candidate who previously contested the seat announced that she was going for pre-selection, which means that he wasn't going to be running, like, you know, he was going to have serious competition.
Yeah.
He got apparently got some pretty unfavorable feedback from locals being like, what are you doing abandoning your local seat here?
Yeah,
I thought you were on our side and you wanted to help us rebuild.
Yep.
But mostly, he blamed it on a guy called John Barilaro.
who a lot of people are blaming a lot of stuff on, which is very reasonable. But
definitely fair. Definitely fair. Now, I looked up how to pronounce a lot of the things in this story. Barilaro is not one of them. Could be Barilaro, could be Barilaro.
I can tell you if you want, but it sounds like just want to muddle through. It's Barilaro.
Barilaro. Okay, great. So, John Barilaro is the Nationals deputy leader in New South Wales, and apparently, according to an article I read, he's got a reputation as being a bit of a Barnaby, but looser, which
is impressive.
Yeah, amazing reputation to have. So he, as you pointed out, Noon, was hoping that, as many Nats do, when seats open up, that the Libs were not going to field a candidate and let him run unopposed and basically get the Liberal votes.
Yeah, right.
Which is a weird thing to expect the Liberal Party to do.
As we've mentioned before on the show, the National Party don't seem capable of realizing that the Liberals are very bad for them, and that the coalition agreement that they have just massively depowers them. And this is
they also don't seem to realize that they are very, very bad for themselves. And this is really a story of of internal implosion within the National Party and also within the coalition. So Barilaro was having a tilt for pre-selection for the Nationals, but he didn't have support from the Nationals' federal leader, Michael McCormack. Michael McCormack doesn't like him. He doesn't like Barilaro. Yeah. And because Barilaro is a Barnaby Joyce guy.
Yeah.
And obviously, Michael McCormack's leadership is currently under threat from Barnaby and his supporters. So Michael McCormack was never going to say, come and join me in the fucking federal party room.
Where will be the one extra vote needed to roll me as leader and get Barnaby back in for some reason.
Exactly. So Barilaro, realizing that he didn't have a shot, withdrew on Monday. He cited, quote, family reasons. And then the texts started happening.
Yeah.
So there were a number of text messages that he sent to McCormack that came out through various media sources. And I'm just going to read a little quote from one. "To feel threatened by me clearly shows that you have failed your team and failed as a leader. You will never be acknowledged by me as our leader. You aren't. You never will be." Which is pretty intense to send to the federal leader of your own political party. This guy is, the Barnaby Joyce, but looser, definitely seems to fit. Go on.
The Daily Telegraph said that Barilaro had called Andrew Constance a cunt, which it seems like happened in private conversation. So unclear exactly how that got to the telly.
Unclear how all these private text messages and conversations within the National Party got leaked to the Daily Telegraph. It's a mystery. Mm-hmm. But Barilaro called Constance a cunt. It was printed on the front page of the Daily Telegraph. It's objectively funny. And then that day, Andrew Constance said, "I'm pulling out. I'm not running. Fuck it." Apparently, this is just a side note.
Yeah.
Apparently, Anthony Albanese was alerted ahead of time to the fact that Constance was going to withdraw from the race with a text message that started with the line, "clusterfuck alert," which I couldn't have put it better myself.
Yeah.
But so Constance gave a short press conference.
Text message, blast group or whatever. I want to get the clusterfuck alerts from the Labour Party.
Me too. Constance gave a short press conference basically saying that he was sick and tired of, the politics of politics, that he reckons that Australia's had a gutful of it. Mm-hmm. He's had a gutful of it. And he said, quote, "When I said politics is stuffed in this country and some of the people in it need to have a long, hard look, I meant it."
Ooh.
And obviously he's talking about Barilaro. And look, here's the thing. I watched that press conference. It made me kind of like him.
Mm.
He was pretty much like, I don't know. It seems like he wanted to retire from politics.
Yeah.
This seat opens up. It looks like there was probably a fair amount of pressure from the Liberal Party, the Federal Party, to make him run because they wanted to nerf. And the locals were not into it.
The other thing is, because of the extremely tight margins, the Libs really need a fucking stellar candidate if they want any hope of winning the seat. And it makes sense that Constance was a candidate for that. Stella in the region.
I'm gonna push back against that.
Sure, go on.
But so yeah, like he stepped down and was basically like, this sucks. I got called a cunt in national media. It's not what I got into politics for. He seems to be sick of the whole situation. It was just like, fuck it. Fair. I'm going back to retiring. So look, a bit of a backflip, but it seems like he never really wanted to do it in the first place. Mm. And like, okay, whatever. You know, I'm not going to have a huge amount of sympathy for a liberal politician, but what amount I could have, I have for this guy.
Fair.
But so, you know, what's the takeaway, I guess, from this little bit of infighting? Well, I think probably the main takeaway is that Michael McCormack still has absolutely no control of the National Party room. That means that he can't guarantee Morrison how his members are going to vote in Parliament. So this, you know, is just a further chipping away, a little bit more instability in the coalition. And Barry Lyra himself is probably completely fucked as a result of this as well. He's, you know, he just went too hard. He was a little bit too loose. So, I don't know. It looks like there's probably going to be a little bit of
backlash at the state reshuffling. Level, whatever sort.
Yeah, for sure. And just to, like, show how fucked things are in the coalition at the moment, Nikki Sava was reporting that the Liberal vice president, Tina McQueen, was apparently, like, sounding people out to see if they would support a Tony Abbott run in the seat.
Which is very
so, like, these are the fucking straws that they're clasping at. It's amazing. But so, okay. It's going to be a tough by-election for the Liberals, right?
Yep.
They need, as you say, a stellar candidate. Mm-hmm. So they're looking around. Oh, we've got this
maybe Tony Abbott
that we can drop in. Yeah, maybe Tony Abbott would be great. What about the person who came within 843 votes of winning the seat at the last federal election?
Oh, yeah.
Didn't make the papers. Didn't get a mention. Woman by the name of Fiona Kotvoys. So she almost took the seat last year.
Yeah.
Big swing towards her. She did all this work with basically no money or resources from head office. No, you know, Scott Morrison didn't drop in to give her his endorsement or whatever.
Which I suspect is because of the bellwether situation that they... I mean, I haven't got any, like, actual source on this, but I suspect that they didn't put money or resources or drop-ins because they figured that they were going to lose the last election. That was the general consensus. And so Eden Monaro, being a bellwether seat, was inevitably going to flip and that they shouldn't even bother campaigning there, which, you know.
Could be true.
Keep going about Fiona.
Yeah, so Kotvoys is she's a truffle farmer. She's a local gal, cool. Grew up on the farm, and she now runs it. She's on the board of Oxfam Australia. She's an RFS volley. Real, like, you know, local community type politician, not this career politician type, but someone who, like, actually grew up in the area and has basically got into, like, charity work and that kind of thing, actually interested in the community, you know, as far as a liberal politician can be.
Yep.
And after poking about in her campaign materials for the last federal election, she seems to basically be a moderate, really trying to brand herself as a centrist, like, sure. A lot of conversation about meeting in the middle. We don't need either extremes, etc. Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. We've basically got, yeah, she's a, you know,
about as good as you might be able to hope for a liberal candidate.
Yeah, look, she doesn't seem particularly heinous, but, you know, more importantly, she's got a local profile and did really well in the seat at the last federal election. So I wonder what the reason could be that she's been basically completely overlooked by the Liberal Party.
What
I mean,
could
she
it
is
be?
About to, yeah, who knows? But she is about to basically Stephen Bradbury this pre-selection, it looks like, and just basically sweep the field now. I don't think she's going to run unopposed, but it looks very likely.
Sorry, is that
a
sports reference?
Yeah, that's that Australian speed skater who won the gold medal in the Olympics after everybody else fell down. Yeah.
Nice. That's a good sports reference. It's a sports meme crossover.
It's probably the only sports reference I can ever make, and I will continue to do so because it was hilarious. Mm. So it looks like she's most likely going to get the Liberal pre-selection there.
Yep.
And the Labor candidate is looking likely to be someone called Christy McBain, who is a pretty different kettle of fish to Fiona Kotvoys. So she's currently the mayor of Bigger Valley Shire for 3 years and 9 months, according to her LinkedIn. And she's a young Laborite. So she is really, like, she's a career politician from day dot. She
Time server.
She's a party person. And she's got Albanese's blessing. And there was some, like, reporting from conservative papers being like, oh, people are unhappy, they think she's a captain's call or whatever. I don't know. It was all from, like, unnamed sources and that kind of thing. So I don't know how much to believe that. But she, like Andrew Constance, was very involved in bushfire recovery efforts and famously worked every day for a month in bushfire recovery centers until she was basically too physically exhausted to do it anymore. And she's very focused on, like, getting resources for the local community as the headline for her run for the seat. She said in her announcement speech, "We still have people living in tents and caravans on their properties." So she's very much about, you know, she's like, what I can do for the recovery effort here by being your federal member.
It is really shocking how little we have done for those people. And, like, bushfires are still raging, but also the, like, coronavirus has just completely shut down any public discussion about trying to fix up some of the damage that was done by the fires. But it's good that there are local, like, political figures working on it. Yeah.
And look, fire season is not that far away now.
No,
last year it started in July. So, it's, you know, it's an awful situation down there and something needs to be done. I'm not sure that either of the major parties are the people to deliver it, but hey. But so look, at the end of the day, after all of this ridiculous infighting between the coalition and all of this, like, egotistical dick waving that's been happening in the media, at the end of the day, it looks like this by-election is most likely going to come down to these two relatively business-like politicians who have just been, in their own way, basically getting the job done and not really, like, making much of a fuss. I am not in any way a political analyst. Like, I love to give my opinion about stuff, but, you know, I don't have any knowledge or skill in that department. But I thought it might be fun to make a prediction. So, what do you reckon, Noon? If it comes down, do you reckon the Libs or Labour are going to take it? Because we know it's not going to be the Nats or the Greens, who I think the Greens are going to field the candidate, but they haven't announced yet.
I'm going to say Clive Palmer.
Wow. Okay.
Just him personally, you know, not
long odds,
his party or whatever. But yeah, that's right. Long odds, but, you know, you put $1 down on sports bet, $30,000 payout if he gets there.
Yeah. Oh, definitely worth a flutter. Absolutely. Yeah. Pop down. Well, you know, do your social distancing down at the TAB. Pop a couple bucks on. I say it's a good idea.
What's your
personally,
prediction?
Personally, look, I reckon that the odds are slightly in Labour's favour here. Obviously, they've got the, you know, history on their side with the 100 years thing. But also, yeah, I think just how badly hit the area was by the bushfires and how negative the coalition's response to that has been is going to be pretty tough to overcome. And especially, like, with all of this ridiculous infighting that's happened over the past couple weeks, like, it really makes them look extremely self-involved and, like, they don't actually give a fuck about the people in the electorate, that it's all about political gain. Fiona Cotvoyce is not someone who I think has been dragged down by that.
Sure.
So I think it will be tight, but, yeah, look, I reckon Labour's probably got the edge here, and if I'm right, I'm going to buy myself a can of Coke.
Nice. All right. Well, that's going to do us for our mains. Before we finish up, I just wanted to have a little positivity corner. Positivity corner. Oh, I already feel more positive. My chakras are just aligning themselves every time I hear that sting. That
my third eye is wide open.
This is a lovely story about everyone's favorite union, RAFWU, the Retail and Fast Food Workers Union.
Yeah.
As we all know, the only actual union for people in fast food and retail. God bless
copyright trademark.
RAFWU.
Fuck yeah, RAFWU.
Long-time listeners and Auspol shitposting members will know this is a indirect dig at the SDA, the Shopkeepers Distributive Alliance, who are technically the actual union for that sector. But there are also, like, loony far-right Catholics who hate abortion and also consistently screw over their workers.
Suck.
Literally at every opportunity they try and make things worse for their workers. So, yeah.
What have they done recently to fuck over the people they represent, Noon?
Well, You know, the SDA, as well as being evil, are also incompetent. So they've completely failed to fuck over their workers this time, despite trying really hard. So the SDA collaborated with the Australian Industry Group, who are basically like the peak body for a bunch of major, major mega corporations in Australia, especially McDonald's. So the SDA and the Australian Industry Group collaborated to put forward some changes to the Fair Work Act that they want implemented. And this actually had the blessing of the ACTU, the Australian Council of Trade Unions, who's the peak body of unions, which is fucked because Bummer. The changes that they were asking for to be made to the Act were basically waiving overtime and penalty rates and a bunch of other protections. And the reason for this is that they said that fast food chains are losing a bunch of income because of the coronavirus, and that they want a handout, and they want that handout in the form of being able to fuck with their workers more. And the commission, basically, because of RAFU, the Retail and Fast Food Workers Union, who put in a bunch of submissions and a bunch of research, and they basically found, the commission found, that McDonald's haven't really lost revenue from the pandemic. They haven't hit the 30% or 50% reduction in turnover that you need to get JobKeeper. Mm-hmm. And so that McDonald's is like, oh, it's so terrible. We haven't lost any business. We need help. why is everyone else getting help just because they need it? And so the fucking
spot on impression of McDonald's.
Yeah, thank you. And the SDA being slimy, subservient toadies to the managerial class, like, yeah, they haven't lost any money. They need more money. And
spot on SDA impression.
Thank you. Yeah, it's exactly the same as the Maccas, but more annoying.
Whinier.
All right, and there's a quote here that I want to read from an Australian Financial Review article about this that I think is very funny, which is, while Justice Ross accepted it was logical that stores without drive-thrus would be affected by the coronavirus restrictions, he said, there's no evidence before us that tells us that they have suffered any loss of revenue at all. And I just love that because they're like, yeah, I guess if you think about it, it makes sense. But then if you think about it more,
it also didn't happen.
It didn't happen. So on that level, no. So, yeah. This
nice
is
try, burger boys.
No, my money.
bang, bang, bang. That's the gavel. No, yeah, money so for you.
Shout-outs, RAFU. Shout-outs to Tilda Joy in Ausbil Shitposting, who is a RAFU person. You guys are doing great work. God bless the one and only Retail and Fast Food Workers Union.
All hail. Woo. All right. That's probably just about going to do us for this week. Thank you very much for tuning in, especially if you are a first-time listener. We really appreciate it. Hope you enjoyed this podcast, which is now over an hour long every week, apparently, bringing you that extra content for the lockdown. We also, on that note, have the next episode of Noon and the Dunce discussing dank Marxist memes. Episode 2 coming out midweek this week, so keep an eye out for that in your feed. We've got more of me not understanding Marxism and Noon explaining it to me via memes coming your way. If you missed the first episode, you can catch it in the feed. It's we put it out last week.
A listener actually contacted me to say that they were discouraged because when I was like, so Zach, do you know what dialectics is? Expecting you to say, no, I've got no fucking clue. You were like, oh yeah, it's this. And I was like, oh, yeah. But anyway, sorry to that listener. if there's not enough dunsing going on, hopefully the next episode, Zach, will be less well-informed.
Yeah, they're like, as they go on, I know less and less. And the last episode is mostly just Noon monologuing and me sitting there being like, I have no idea what's going on.
Oh, that's a shame.
No, it's good. It's really about you monologuing. And if I don't have something to interject with, I don't. But yeah, so keep an eye out for that. That's going to be that's a four-part miniseries, so we'll be bringing you those
for the next
couple of weeks as well. If you like the show, it would really help us out if you shared us around. We don't use Twitter very much, but one of the very few times that we receive notifications is when we get mentioned in a reply to a tweet where someone has been like, hey, I want to listen to a new Australian podcast. Does anyone have any recommendations? And then someone responds Ospos Nakpod and tags us. And that's just so sweet when that happens. Josh Cake did that for us this week.
Thanks,
Josh. That story is just a really lovely notification to get when people share us around. So that would be a huge help for us. If you
tell
see
your
anyone
friends,
on Twitter,
we're Australia's foremost political nobodies.
Yeah, we got it right about the shenanigans, and we'll maybe get it right about more shenanigans. share us around on Facebook or Insta or other socials. We'd really appreciate it. And if you really like what we do and you want to help us out financially, you can go over to our Patreon and support us for as little as $1 a month, which gets you a monthly bonus episode. Plus, you help us make more stuff, which we release for everybody, such as Noon and the Dunce. So, again, thank you very much for tuning in, Noon. It's been an absolute pleasure to spend the time with you, brightening my lockdown, brightening my weekend. Lovely way to start off my Sunday. I hope that you, listener, take it easy, and I hope that you, Noon, keep on snacking in the free world.
I've only got one thing to say to you, Zach.
What's that?
Crunch, crunch.